Welcome, everyone, to episode 369 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to take a step back now that the playoffs are over and look at the overarching lessons that we've learned from the playoffs and what they mean moving forward with the draft and free agency coming up. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews, and we are being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is the guy who I'm going to apply for a disability exception for, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
It's going well, Brian. It's going well. I was about to make a joke on that because I was going to say, you know, these days I'm positive and thus optimistic, but at no point could I be as optimistic as Lakers fans are right now with the Luol Deng, you know, career-ending injury exception demand.
Request.
They applied for the league to get that. Yeah, the request. I don't think the league is going to approve that because that is just going to open a can of worms.
I mean, this just came out earlier today, so we're not going to go too deep into it because the consensus does seem to be that it's basically like the Lakers shooting their shot just to try to get some more cap space. And hey, why not? You know, give them credit for being creative here. But yeah, if it does work, Al Horford better have a career-ending injury tomorrow. That's all I'm saying.
That's not cool. Let's not root for injuries.
Just a quote-unquote career-ending injury.
Yeah. Oh, quote-unquote. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. I gotcha.
Yeah. Let him get his money, but he will never play basketball again. That'll be great. We all win here.
I hope that Anna Horford isn't listening.
Let her. Now we've had, you know, a week or so to kind of digest the playoffs at whole. So I thought today we would go back and, you know, we've been teasing at some of these ideas throughout our analysis of the playoffs, but I think it'd be valuable with the draft and free agency coming up to, you know, kind of look at the lessons that we might have learned from the playoffs this year, the bubble, and see what we think it, you know, is worth that could carry over moving forward. Like, what was an outlier of just this is a weird situation, and then, you know, what should front offices, GMs be considering as we move into the draft and free agency? So the first thing is, I mean, we've seen this, you know, with the Warriors, especially over the last 5 years, was when they won, teams started to adapt to them. They started to, you know, realize like we need to have some counter to that death lineup in particular. The Lakers were the exact opposite of that. I mean, they started, you know, Anthony Davis at the four for most of the year, either one of JaVale McGee or Dwight Howard at the five. So they went big ball. So, you know, is small ball now dead? And do teams need to adjust and start prioritizing bigs in free agency in the draft and trades, knowing that the Lakers are looming and they might, you know, still be in that title mix next year?
No. Because, so JaVale McGee, if I'm reading this right, and I do think it's correct, didn't even play in the finals. Dwight Howard played less than 12 minutes per game in the finals. Mm-hmm. So basically their biggest player on the court at all times were either Anthony Davis or, you know, Markieff Morris / Kyle Kuzma. I would argue Markieff plays bigger than Kuzma. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it was very perimeter-oriented in terms of getting the three off. They were really focusing a lot on getting the three-ball up there. And then I think just the element of LeBron kind of overrides and succeeds everything else in the way. Like, you cannot take a LeBron-led team and go, oh, we've learned this about NBA trends, because LeBron is a trend in and of itself. He's one-to-one. I don't think we can use a team with his presence on and go, this is the way a team needs to play. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always felt that size was important to some extent. Like, I've said this repeatedly, that I don't think the center position is dead, which a lot of people have said over the years. I think it's the power forward position that's died. And if there's something that I've taken away from this season, not just the bubble, the entirety of the 2019-2020 season, it's that the traditional power forward, I think, is definitely dead. If you can't play make or defend at a high level or shoot at a high level, and not just one of the each, but like have a significant combination of those skills at the four, then you're just not going to be a winning, contribute to a winning team.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to be slow-footed, you're not going to have the necessary ball handling, you're not going to have the playmaking ability. And for now, I think teams should basically start with playing four out and then one big, like four perimeter-oriented players, preferably two small forwards at the forward positions, then one traditional-ish center, and I say that quote-unquote, because what I mean by a traditional center, I just mean someone who can defend. I don't care about that center hitting the three ball necessarily. He doesn't have to play a big part in the offense. He just needs to anchor my defense and reap out the ever-living hell out of that basketball. If I've got that at the five, then I have four, you know, very flexible players running around the court who can cut and screen and shoot and initiate the offense altogether. And that's how I would build a team in 2020. Like, I am very, very concerned about, you know, Chicago's position with Lauri Markkanen, because he's not a traditional, he is a traditional four, and that's the problem. I'm actually nervous about the Hawks with John Collins, because Collins as well is also a traditional four. And I'm slightly worried about my man crush, Christian Wood, because defensively, he's just not good enough to play center. Offensively, I think he could play the center position, but defensively, there are some major concerns. So I think the days of, you know, the 6'10 power forward who plays, you know, from outside and in, but who is very reliant upon getting set up, I think those are dead and buried.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, as good as the Lakers looked using these bigger lineups, as you said, they didn't do it as much in the finals, but, you know, against Denver, we did see Dwight Howard in particular take on some additional importance. But as good as they looked doing that, the counterpoint is, well, you know, the Sixers were supersized and they were abysmal to watch all year. And then, like, the Knicks also went to the 16 power forwards model, and look how far that got them. So I'm with you in thinking, like, if teams see the Lakers and say, oh, okay, we just need to go back to two bigs in the lineup at all times, you know, I think teams that prioritize shooting above all else are going to have advantages over the teams that are like, we're going to beat you with stars in defense and rebounding. All of that stuff is important, for sure. I'm not downplaying any of it, but you also need shooting in today's league. It's just, it's become so painfully obvious. And the Lakers learned that the hard way the first year with LeBron, where they didn't have that, and they weren't what they were this past year. They learned from their mistakes and loaded up on shooting, but then also got a couple bigs in there. It really allowed them to play in a number of different ways. But, you know, I'm looking ahead to the draft in particular, because, you know, it seems like the, I don't want to say consensus, because there isn't a consensus even at the top of this board, but
correct.
You know, that a lot of the guys mentioned toward the top are LaMelo Ball, Anthony Edwards, both of whom are guards. James Wiseman was in that top three mix for most of the year. And then Onyeka Okongwu as well. Do you think, you know, guys like Okongwu and Wiseman, because of what the Lakers did, like a team like the Warriors, for instance, that have the number two pick, we know they're trying to trade it, but if they can't, do they see the Lakers looming and say, hey, you know what? Actually, we maybe should take one of these bigs over a LaMelo Ball or an Anthony Edwards?
I think they would take a big, but not because of the Lakers. So here's the thing. Here's a dirty little secret about the 2020 NBA draft that most people are ignoring. Obviously, we've talked about Anthony Edwards and LaMelo Ball, who could be very, very influential guard players. The thing is, though, the most safe players in this draft, the three safest players, are James Wiseman, Obi Toppin from Dayton, who's a power forward slash center in the NBA, and Onyeka Okongwu. Those three are absolutely, you know, safe picks. You know what you're going to get with those guys. They're going to come in, and at least Wiseman and Okongwu are going to protect the rim. Toppin is just going to score the ever-living hell out of the basketball constantly because he's got that ability. You can pick and roll defenses to death with him. Like, that should be a transferable skill. And you know, Okongwu as well, like almost 3 blocks a game from USC. And James Wiseman, 7'1", 7'6", wingspan, supremely athletic. You know, we've heard some rumblings lately that he actually gained a little bit weight, not in a bad sense, but like he got ripped. It was muscle, and he looks way more refined now.
Mm-hmm.
So we are looking at those guys, and they are on the, you know, on the board at that range, and are candidates at that range because not because they're bigs, but because, you know, this is a really, really bad draft, and they are some of the surest things there. And teams would like to walk away from this draft with something that they feel is somewhat safe. I mean, if we've ever had a draft before that I could refer to as a rubber draft, this is it. I mean, this is the ultimate condom draft. You play it safe all the way through.
Yeah, and we'll get more, we'll have plenty of episodes within the next few weeks just specifically on draft stuff. But, you know, I think one point about those guys, you know, if teams don't prioritize them for whatever reason, or if they're willing to take bigger home run swings, is that free agency, you know, there should be a lot of centers on the market, and I can't imagine many of them are going to command, I mean, honestly, I don't know if any of them are going to command more than the mid-level. Like, if Andre Drummond opted out, he would. But, you know, Hassan Whiteside, Marc Gasol, Tristan Thompson, Mason Plumlee, Myers Leonard, Aaron Baines. I don't know if... Yeah. I would guess Robin Lopez and Enes Kanter both probably opt in, just seeing that there isn't much of a market out there for them. But, you know, Alex Len, JaVale McGee, like, there's a lot of guys out there that could fill the role that McGee and Howard did this year, where, you know, you're not relying on these guys for 35 minutes a game as your starting center, but they can be your, like, token center for 15 minutes a game.
Right.
So, you know, I think that teams are going to be reluctant. Like, if anything, this is, the Lakers winning is kind of bad news for bigs, just because they proved that if you have Anthony Davis, which is obviously very rare, but, you know, you don't need two elite bigs. You can have your one guy, and then you can just have that fill-in center who we either get. I think what JaVale was he the room exception, or I don't even remember.
That's a good question. It was a low contract.
Yeah, at the very and least. Then Dwight was a min deal, so, you know, there's just, like, Nerlens Noel's out there too. Are you gonna, you know, you could probably get him for the room exception, and like Nerlens would be a great fit at that price, I think. So there should be a lot of options out there for teams that are looking to fortify their front courts, and I'm interested to see how the Lakers' success determines their market in particular.
Yeah. I mean, I don't look at the Lakers necessarily as they won because of size. I think they won because of defense, and defense was played, you know, in a very cohesive manner.
Mm-hmm.
And you could argue that started all the way down from Avery Bradley. You know, I know he wasn't in the bubble, but during the course of the season, he was there. LeBron was locked in. I mean, we heard as much from Zach Lowe recently. I think that was on the last episode of the Full 48. Lowe basically said that LeBron had heard all the noise. Mm-hmm. You know, he had heard. He was seeing himself on those highlight reels that we put up of Harden. You know, when he makes a defensive mistake, like, oh, he turns his head, boom, he's gonna get burned. LeBron had seen a little bit too many of those over the past couple of years, and he was determined to change the narrative. So I think that's where that started. I think it was the defense, and I think ultimately, even if the Lakers hadn't had Dwight or JaVale, I kind of still think they would have come out on top.
I'd be interested to see how they would have fared against Denver without those guys. I mean, not to say that they definitely would have lost, but I think that series would have at least given them more trouble.
It possibly. I mean, you might be right. And hell, look, it could make the difference for one series. What I'm saying is, I don't necessarily think that you are going to find yourself in that spot every single time. Like, you know, it also depends on, of course, who you match up with. In the East, there's just no big concern. I'm sorry. I mean, I know Joel is there, but if he's the focal point and there's no shooting around him, like, fine, let him eat.
Well, I mean,
it's okay.
It's really, it's Embiid, Jokic, and then Bam is probably the only other big that you really need to game plan around, right?
Right. Well, and Davis, right?
But yeah, I mean, and you know, in theory, if you're counting Bam as a center, but and you know, from the Lakers' perspective, I guess Gobert, but you don't game plan like you're not concerned about him offensively.
I think you also game plan for Giannis, who is, you know, a lot. He's playing those big positions now. I mean,
yeah,
you know, we talk a lot about him being like a three. He's not. He's like a 4 or 5, and that's the thing. Like, even him, that he's one of the exceptions to the rule that I made earlier, because he can do everything from the four. Like, he's the definition of positionless, but he's not a point guard. Like, he is playing the big positions. He's guarding the big positions. So I think you can throw him into that category as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point is that, like, if you're in the West in particular, there just aren't that many teams with centers who you're like, oh, crap, if I don't have someone to counter them, I'm in trouble. I get Portland with Nurkic could be as well. But, you know, like Dallas and Porzingis, like, the Lakers are fine. They'll just, all right, AD on Porzingis, done, easy. You know, Houston, no. Memphis, Jaren Jackson could get there in time, but, like, Jonas Valanciunas, no. Pelicans, we'll see what happens with Derek Favors, but no. LaMarcus Aldridge in San Antonio, no. You know, go down the list. Like, Ayton, I guess, with the Suns eventually, but we're still a ways away from that, I think. So,
yeah,
especially for teams in the West, they just might not be concerned with this outside. You know, they'd be looking at the Lakers as the one team where you do have to be worried about, but other than that, you know, they're probably just like, yeah, right, I don't really care.
I think the logic from NBA teams also in the downsizing apartment is that you see so many bigs. We also forgot Karl-Anthony Towns, I think.
Yeah, but you have to. They're not making the playoffs next year.
No, not in playoff context, but he's definitely a guy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if that team becomes good, you are absolutely worried about him. But I think NBA teams are looking at it in a way as, if you are a big man who needs to be fed, and you need to be assisted at a high rate to be effective, that just strains your offense a little bit more, because then you become reliant upon somebody else making that play, if you catch my drift.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are entering an era where self-creation and creation for others, having the ability to do both, is basically the most important thing you can have as a basketball player. So teams are going to go out looking for two-way players at virtually every position who can create for themselves and others. And that's like the, at some point we're going to see some center who is, you know, we're actually seeing already. Nikola Jokic, we're seeing it already. But someone who can take the ball out from the backcourt, initiate the entire offense and create something for himself, like he can go straight into the post or he can pull up for three. He can create everything for everyone else. Like, he is the guy that I think big men are now going to be trying to emulate, because, you know, outside of defense, he has virtually no weakness. I think this we're going to see a very different league in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bam too. Bam is going to force a lot of teams to evolve. Yeah. So
yeah, and next year Wendell Carter Jr. could be one of those as well, because he came in with a similar skill set. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we might be seeing players on that rise, like Jaren Jackson Jr., who ultimately projects as a center. I think,
yeah,
like he can handle the ball as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a different era, and I just think, the center is still going to be there, but it's just going to be a very warped version of it.
Yeah. So another team building lesson that, you know, we were kind of dancing around for a while now was, you know, the 2016 cap spike led to the unprecedented Big Four in Golden State, which just, it's almost impossible to replicate. The teams had been, you know, from the Celtics to the Miami Heatles, the Cavaliers in the mid-2010s, the Clippers with Lob City. The Big Threes had been a thing for the last decade. And, you know, this past summer we saw really there weren't any more Big Threes. It became a league of Big Twos. We saw the Lakers win a title with a Big Twos, which sort of validated that theory. We talked last episode or two episodes ago about how we got so hung up on like the question of who's the third best player, and it ultimately didn't matter because they just had someone to take that role every night. And it, you know, it changed by night or it changed based on matchup, which is it worked out for them. So I think it did at least validate the premise that a big two can work. But one thing I will note is that the big two have to be consistent. Because, you know, LeBron, you know what you're getting out of him every night. Anthony Davis was fantastic for most of the playoffs. He had a few clunkers in the finals, and the Heat won those games. But you look at a team like the Clippers, where, save for Game 7 against Denver, I mean, Kawhi Leonard was fantastic every single night, but Paul George was so bad for a lot of the time in the playoffs that he got the nickname Pandemic P. So, you know, I think if moving forward, I think teams might see the Lakers and say, oh, okay, we don't necessarily need to get three superstars. We can win with two, but we need to know that we can count on these two guys every single night.
Right. Yeah, so I was going to say something similar to that vein, but you know, you touched on consistency. I think consistency is important. That said, I also think you just need to have, you know, the primary sidekick be a top 10 player. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it comes down to now. Like, if you're going to win with a two-star system, you're going to have two of the very best. That is in large part why I've been advocating for the whole Giannis to Dallas thing, because ultimately, you know, Giannis and Chris Middleton, great. Chris Middleton is very consistent. That's great. Chris Middleton is not a top 10 NBA player. And you know, he can't carry that entire team. I know that he did have that one crazy ass game against Miami, but like he can't carry the entire team when Giannis is not, you know, available. And you need to have that guy. You basically need to have two very straightforward superstars. And if you look in Dallas, like, okay, so let's say Luka goes down for a game. Can Kristaps Porzingis be the guy for a couple games? Maybe not in the playoff series. Like, he can't reliably create his own shot for 35, 46 minutes if need be. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to have two top 10 guys alongside each other. I think that has to be the mentality going into things.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, I mean, LeBron and AD were just such a perfect fit on paper, and that translated to the court. You know, where a team like the Sixers with Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, it's, you know, just been an uphill battle the whole time. Like, they, both of those guys could be top 10 players eventually, and that's the theory of why you don't trade either one. But it's like, at a certain point, are we sure that they're ever going to really work together with the constraints around them that, you know, with,
oh, I am sure
that they will, that not, they're not. Right, yeah. But I wonder what it means for a team like the Brooklyn Nets in particular, where you have Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving returning next year. You will see what they do this offseason with their supporting cast. There have long been rumors that they're looking to continue go star hunting. You know, I know you've been skeptical about the Nets, largely because of their potential chemistry concerns with KD and Kyrie. But, you know, on paper, it's like KD and Kyrie, if KD recovers from the Achilles injury and is his old self, which is a huge if. But on paper, like, that's the formula, right? Like, they have two top 10, top 15 stars, and then they've got a pretty strong supporting cast. Like, on paper, they have the recipe to be in that title mix next year, yeah?
Absolutely. And just to preface this, I want to say that, you know, part of my skepticism, yes, was chemistry, but you just touched on it. You said a big if. If Kevin Durant had not gotten injured last year, then my stance on the Nets would look dramatically different. Mm. Like, this is the Achilles injury. Mm-hmm. This is the Achilles tear for someone who's going to be, what, 32?
Yeah, I believe so.
I mean, so, yeah, okay. No, but you're right, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, we'll see what happens, but, you know, I know that's been kind of the debate on Nets Twitter in particular is, you know, we have Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie, Jared Allen. Like, in theory, that gets you in the door for any of these star trade conversations. Like, that's a pretty compelling offer. I mean, you know, right. I think if they offered some combination of those, even if it's, you know, the Wizards aren't willing to trade Bradley Beal, the Sixers aren't willing to trade one of their two guys, move the next rung down, and, you know, that the Pacers would gladly do some combination of that for Victor Oladipo, I would think. Mm-hmm. What about Chris Middleton?
Yeah. You and I have brought him up before.
Yeah. And I wonder if...
For the Nets.
That could be a good move for both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, hey, I mean, you and I agreed that it would be a great trade because, you know, while Chris Middleton is not a top 10 player, he is what you asked for. He's extremely consistent. You know, he's not going to have those, you know, off nights like Caris LeVert. He's not going to have as low a efficiency game as Caris LeVert. He's going to be healthier. He's going to be better defensively than both LeVert and Dinwiddie combined.
Mm-hmm.
He would be a great glue guy for Kyrie and KD. The question becomes, you know, what does Chris Middleton become if chemistry issues arise? That's the big question for me. But on paper, Chris Middleton should be target number one. I know that Bradley Beal is the guy that they want.
Mm-hmm.
And they also like are apparently keeping tabs on a lot of stars around the league. Chris Middleton should be the guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. But I mean, do you think, you know, having seen the big two work, do you think mm-hmm. the Nets need to go star hunting for that third big guy, or should they just see what they have in their current roster?
I mean, so as far as I'm concerned, right now the Nets don't have a top two because we don't know. It's like we can't sit here. I understand your premise. I really mm-hmm. do, and I'm not trying to beat a dead horse, but we just don't know how KD is going to look. If this is 50% the KD that we know, then that's not a tier one superstar. If it's 90% the KD we know, perfect, awesome. That'd be great. Then we can talk about it. Then we're right there. My question here, the follow-up one, is Kyrie a superstar, or is he just, you know, that guy who's been brought along for so long that we look at the scoring, we look at the highlights, we look at the championship he won with LeBron, and we're going, oh, yeah, superstar. Because I even if we ignore all the chemistry issues,
mm-hmm.
and we really shouldn't because those matter in a superstar context,
right?
I don't think he's a superstar, Bri.
I don't think he's a number one option. I don't think right. he's a number one option on a title team. I should say that.
Right, but like even Anthony Davis, who was number two this year,
mm-hmm.
is drastically better.
Oh, for sure.
Than Kyrie Irving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without question. I mean, Kyrie has proved that he can be a number two on a title team, but yeah. I'm with you that Anthony Davis is a significantly better player than him. I mean, AD, just defensively, what he brings
right. is
worlds better than Kyrie on that end. And, you know, mix in the offense, and yes, it is, the gap between them is yawning. That said, I mean, you know, we it's hard to read into this season of Kyrie just because, you know, I think he only played 20 games and the Nets just weren't, like, this was always going to be basically a punt year. Like, they knew when they signed Kevin Durant, he's not playing this year. You know, we can evaluate how our young guys fit next to Kyrie, but like 2020, 2021, and that's when we get the pedal to the metal and we're actually title contenders. So, I mean, it's a really tricky question, I think, for Sean Marks in that front office. The good thing is they have more intel than all of us. Like, we can only speculate what KD looks like right now and how he's been recovering from that injury. They presumably are seeing it firsthand. I don't know the scope to which he's allowed in the facility right now, given COVID restrictions, but like they've, you know, been able to keep better track of it than we have. So I think that will influence right. their decision-making this offseason, knowing, okay, going back to your question, do we get 50% of old KD or 90%? They'll have a pretty good sense of that, hopefully.
Right, and for the record, I am rooting for 90%, 100% obviously, KD.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to be, you know, I'm not going to sit here and just be, you know, needlessly optimistic and say, oh, for sure, that's going to happen. That's the version we're going to get, because we don't know.
Right. I forget who asked this on Twitter, but someone asked recently, like, if you had to win a title next year, like, how many players would you pick above KD? And it's like, that's really tough, because you know what the ceiling is, but we have no idea what the floor is, and we have no idea which one he's closer to right now.
Yeah, that's a really good way of phrasing it. I wouldn't dare touch that.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to win a title next year, like, I'm taking Damian Lillard over him right now, I think, just knowing, again, Kevin Durant, fully healthy pre-Achilles, is a much better player than Damian Lillard, but there's just so much uncertainty with him. So I think the Nets, you know, just looking ahead to the offseason, are going to be one of the most fascinating teams, because they have, again, they have this trade package that they can assemble for any star if they really want to, or they could just run it with what they have right now, and, you know, we'll see what shape KD is in next year. But, you know, on paper, they've got the formula for a legit, like, they'll be right, in theory, right in that mix with Milwaukee, Boston, Miami at the top of the East.
Right. I mean, yeah, theoretically, absolutely. And that's where, to me, I gotta admit, I am very quick to just cast them aside.
Mm-hmm.
And in large part, I mean, that's no secret. I think when you have someone like Kyrie on the roster, who is just such a problematic personality, I don't think you are necessarily going to get far. That is going to be the biggest hurdle. And I understand people are high on the Nets, but I think people are also underestimating, not new you necessarily, but I think people are underestimating, you know, the character and the fit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the reasons we saw LeBron and AD just work so well off each other was because they bought in together. Like, the egos were set at the door for those two in between.
Right.
Like, yeah, okay, they had some fights with the rest of the team because, compared to those two, everyone else was trash. Sorry, but I mean, let's be honest here. The drop-off was insane.
Right.
But those two in between, they had a great working relationship. Can you really say the same about Kyrie?
We'll see. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he...
Well, we've said we'll see so many times, and every single time we've said that, he comes out and does something really, really stupid, especially like throwing his teammates under the bus. And like, I'm just done with the whole guessing game. I basically accepted he's just not ever going to be a good teammate. I mean, why would he turn that narrative around? He's one of the most stubborn players in NBA history, I want to say.
Yeah. This Nets conversation leads into, I think, one of the other big lessons from the playoffs, which really, it wasn't just this year that we've learned this. It's really, I think we mentioned this a few episodes ago, it's been kind of the past 10 years, is the importance of two-way wings in particular, versatility as well, but really, like, you almost need a star two-way wing to have a legit title shot. And, you know, whether it's...
Oh, there's no almost to it.
Yeah. So whether it's, you know, LeBron, Kawhi, KD, or say a Jimmy Butler, who, you know, proved he's in that conversation as well. So I think, you know, again, looking to the draft more than free agency, really, because there aren't, like, Brandon Ingram is the closest thing to that in free agency this year, and the Pelicans are going to retain him. So, you know,
right, and he still isn't like a great defender by any stretch.
Right, like, you could, in theory, you can see. He has the tools. He could get there. Like, physically, he could get there. Sure. But yes, he's not anywhere near there right now. So, I mean, this is more for a draft and trades, I guess, conversation. But, you know, how do you think this, seeing what guys like LeBron, Jimmy, Kawhi, how important they were to their teams, looking ahead to the draft, do you think that helps out someone like a Devin Vassell? You know, workout video, recent leaked workout video where he had terrible shooting form aside, you know, you were talking earlier, like, teams want the safer thing. Does that push him up the board knowing that he at least could fit that mold?
Yeah, he's one of those guys who are also looked at as being a safe guy. I mean, again, I've heard privately that even the Hornets at number three were considering him. I don't know if they still do. But you know, he's one of those guys. He's perfect profile, 6'7", 200 pounds, long arms, you know, can shoot, can defend at a high level. Yeah, he's in that conversation with James Wiseman, Onyeka Okongwu, and Obi Toppin. The thing is, though, you're always going to have a cap on Devin Vassell because he's not a shot creator, at least not yet. He's shown a little bit of self-creation, but the big question is whether that could be, you know, that's transferable to the NBA, which I have some doubts about. The one guy that I think can really put this entire draft, you know, upside down is Anthony Edwards. Mm-hmm. And I've said this repeatedly, so I'm just going to, repeat myself again. He is a very sturdy 6'4", 6'5", 220, 225 pounds. He's athletic as all hell. And there are games, or there were games, rather, where he used that tremendous athleticism to assert himself defensively, where he was locked in and he was focused and he wasn't having Eddie Curry syndrome, where he didn't care. And when he did that, he was a game-changing defender. I think the best bet for Anthony Edwards when he comes into the NBA is to dedicate himself defensively and say, you know what, I have a lot in my bag offensively. That's going to come in time, and it's going to come very naturally just as I mature. Mm-hmm. It's the defensive end. If I can become that, I can become a Jimmy. I can become a Kawhi. I can become one of those guys because I have such ease finding my shots because I'm so athletic. I can get to point A to point B whenever I want. I can get to every spot on the floor that I need to go to, but it's the defense that I need to tighten up with. But I mean, to his credit, you know, to his benefit rather, he's got it. Like, he's got the athleticism, he's got the length, he's got the speed, he's got the explosiveness. If this guy is not a new Andrew Wiggins and he actually is a very dedicated basketball player, he could become a superstar.
Right.
And that's why I still think on some level he's the highest upside guy in the entire draft.
Yeah, I was going to say the Wiggins vibes is the biggest knock against him, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. And look, so I have a theory, and it's I'm not presenting this as fact whatsoever. So I want to be, you know, very, very, you know, I want to reiterate that this is just a thought that I've had. We've seen Ben Simmons, for example, when he was at LSU. You know, you could argue he did not give a damn.
Right.
You know, he was just waiting for the NBA to kind of arrive because of the one-and-done rule. He was like, okay, I have to spend a year doing something, and might as well play some college ball and wait it out.
Mm-hmm.
I have a thought that basically Anthony Edwards, who took almost 7 threes a game despite shooting under 30%, I think he was just basically in that mindset of, oh, let me just jack jumpers until I make it to the NBA because then I avoid injuries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true. It could be that he, you know, he really is an Andrew Wiggins clone and he doesn't care. But, I mean, given the way that players and pundits and all look at college, would you really blame a college player who is projected to go in the top five, if not top three, for just basically saying, well, I'm secured that spot either way, I might as well just take a bunch of jumpers and limit my injury risk?
Right. No, absolutely not. It's honestly the smart play.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if it's true.
Right. That's what teams need to figure
very,
out.
Very, very important, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought up Wiggins because he's another one where, you know, at this point, it feels like he is who he is at this point. But, you mm-hmm. know, the Warriors are just, like, out there lurking right now. Like, you know, they had this lost year where Klay was going to be out all year. KD leaves. Steph hurts his hand and is out for most of the year. Draymond, you know, just went on vacation basically, but like they're still coming back next year with Steph, Clay, Dre, you know, the three foundational pieces of their title team. They have the number two pick, whether they trade it or not. They have this giant trade exception from Andre Iguodala, whether they use it or not. And then there's Wiggins, who, you know, if he really does dedicate himself to defense, I mean, it's never been the question about Wiggins has never been about his physical profile and his athleticism. It's just like he's just been so frustratingly inconsistent. But if he emerges as that two-way wing for the Warriors, they could be right in that mix too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, certainly could.
Like, I don't know. It would not surprise me at all if the Golden State Warriors come back next year and are just, it's right back to 2015 all over again.
No, and you know, I think we've said as much before that the Warriors are just a sleeping giant right now. I think the question is Klay Thompson and the ACL tear. You know, how will he cope with that? That's the biggest one for me. Like, Steph is going to be okay. It plays to you know, Klay's game that the ACL injury might not be as problematic because his game was never reliant upon athleticism.
Right.
I mean, hell, the guy barely dribbles.
Right.
He's just basically spotting up and shooting. So if there's an injury out there that he would be able to overcome somewhat easily, I would argue it's the ACL tear. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, he might lose a step defensively, but offensively, I think he should be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on the Warriors sleeping giant train for sure. If I don't think sports betting is legal in Maryland, but if it is, or if it were, I would be placing a small amount of money on the Warriors title. I don't know what the Warriors titles odds are next year, but...
Well, betting is very much allowed in Denmark, so DM me, right, and then we'll figure something out.
There we go.
We'll make a pool.
Listeners, we need you guys to listen, share the podcast even more so we can gamble all of our podcast money, all of our tens of dollars of podcast money on the Warriors title odds. But that leads into the next point, which is, I think we should wrap up by kind of just giving a very preliminary look at the 2020-2021 season. And I think one of the big takeaways from these playoffs is, you know, we knew all year Lakers, Clippers, Bucks were the top tier title favorites and did not hold true in the playoffs. Clippers and Bucks both lost in the second round. I think all three of those teams are going to be back next year. I'm not too concerned. We'll see what moves they make this offseason. If, you know, God forbid Giannis doesn't sign the Supermax and they trade him away, I will remove the Bucks from that top tier title contender mix. But I think all three are there. I think Miami, Boston, and Denver are all here to stay as well, though.
Yeah. Yeah, at least for the time being. I could see Miami maybe dropping off a little bit as Jimmy gets older if they don't get someone in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, they're going to get someone because that culture has just... That's been talked about so much, it's basically, you know, gotten everyone's attention.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Long-term-wise, I agree with you. The Heat is there to stay in terms of being one of those giants. I mean, look, they won the first title in 2006. So over the past, 14 years, they've been in how many finals? Six finals?
Yeah. That sounds right. 2006, 21 through 2014. 2011, sorry. 2011 through 2014.
Yeah.
And then, this year. So that's six.
Yeah. I mean, that's not bad. That is the foundation of a team that could be, you know, finding themselves there more and more frequently.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the good thing, like the Lakers we touched on a few episodes ago, they, you know, a lot of their guys are free agents. They can re-sign them with certain mechanisms, bird rights, mid-level exception, minimum deals, whatever. The Heat, at least next year, have most of their guys already under contract. Goran Dragic and Jay Crowder are the glaring exceptions, but like Jimmy's under contract, Bam's under contract, Duncan Robinson's under contract, Tyler Hero's under contract, Andre Iguodala's under contract. Like they don't have a lot of work to do next year to bring back this exact same core. Like they throw 1 year balloon deals at Jay and Dragic and they can call it an off season if they really want. You know, we mentioned they could have a ton of cap space, and like Danilo Gallinari's out there. Davis Bertans is out there. They could seek a significant upgrade if they don't want to put all their eggs in the 2021 free agency bucket. So, you know, I'm going to write something for Forbes about that because I think it is going to be tricky for them to kind of balance those two competing interests of, you know, we just made the finals. Jimmy Butler is 31, I believe. You know, he's fantastic right now, but are we concerned that a drop-off could be imminent at some point? And, like, do we need to maximize our title window right now? Or do we also need to look ahead and say, you know, Bam and Tyler Hero are the future of this franchise? Like, we, even if it means we are compromising our chances to win a title next year, we need to keep that flexibility for 2021. So if Giannis is willing to come in particular, like, we've got the foundation for the next decade at this point.
Yeah. It's funny we talk about, like, the potential trio of Jimmy, Giannis, and Bam when none of them can really shoot.
I know.
And we're sitting here talking about shooting is so vital.
I know. I mean, I have concerns about that. And, like, Victor Oladipo, too. Yeah. I mean, I don't love the fit there from Miami's perspective.
Nope, neither do I. I look, offensively, I'd much rather have a Buddy Hield in there than I would, you know, Victor Oladipo, because good Lord, Duncan Robinson. So here's the, here's what they should do, Brian. Let's go get it. They trade for Buddy Hield and they sign Davis Bertans. So their starting lineup is basically Jimmy, Buddy, Duncan Robinson, Bertans, and Bam. And then Tyler Hero off the bench, who just bombs threes as well. They would average like 16, 17 mate threes per game, and it would be glorious.
Yeah. Then Daryl Morey comes to work under Pat Riley. It's like, please, please, Pat, this is, you built the team.
I'll pay you, Pat.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. I mean, the Heat, like, I think even if they don't make it back to the finals next year, you know, I think all year they had the perception of being like a step down from a legitimate title contender. It was like entering the year with Milwaukee and Philly, then Philly was terrible, so it was Milwaukee and Boston and Toronto as kind of the big three, and Miami was in that next tier with, like, if things break right, you know, they're with there with Indiana and Philly. And then it's like, no, I think Miami proved they belong in that top tier of title contenders next year. I think it yeah. could be, depending on what we talked about with Brooklyn earlier, like, if everything breaks right for Brooklyn, we could have a pretty loaded top tier with Miami, Boston, Brooklyn, Miami. We'll see what happens in Toronto. If they can bring those guys back, they're right in that mix too.
I could see Brooklyn having a better regular season record than Miami and then getting completely annihilated by them in the playoffs.
Yeah. I could, yeah, they don't have a good answer for Bam, do they?
They don't, but also just, you know, the Heat are so experienced now. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to go full throttle in the regular season. Like, very much like the Lakers, they're going to be like, yeah, we have our eyes on something else. I mean, look, just Jimmy this year, during the regular season, people were like, less than 20 points per game, like, just ho-hum.
Right.
Yeah, because he was just kind of playing a more relaxed brand of basketball. He was, you know, he was delegating and he was playmaking and he wasn't about to go out and get you 25 a game. And then when the finals came around, boom, he locked in. And I think the Heat is just at that point now. Like, I think Bam, this year was the best thing that could have happened for Bam, just in terms of understanding, you know, situation. Mm-hmm. Now he's been to the finals. Mm-hmm. He's hungry now. Next year, Bam is going to be so much better, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, Boston, I think there's no reason to think they're going to be worse next year. Like, their young guys are all still, you know, you can reasonably project growth for Tatum and Brown. Robert Williams is lurking. Grant Williams is lurking. They really didn't get much out of Romeo Langford. They have three first-round picks this year. Not that I think they're going to use all three, but, you know, they have that in their war chest to either trade up or, you know, use one to trade Gordon Hayward and get something else. Like, they have a ton of flexibility, as always.
And they should trade up.
Yeah. I mean, if they can, I think they'll find about 10 teams willing to trade down.
Oh, yeah. No, they should trade up and get Onyeka Okongwu because they are still in need of a center.
Mm.
And I think he fits the Boston mold so well.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big missing piece, right? Daniel Theis is a very good stopgap, but I don't think anyone would call him an elite center by any means. So I think that is the big hole for them to fill, especially if you're looking ahead to a potential Lakers-Boston finals or, you know, another Boston-Miami Eastern Conference finals or even Boston-Milwaukee with the Giannis problem. You know, hopefully Kemba's knees are okay and Gordon Hayward should be recovered by next season. Like, hopefully he could stay healthy for a full year, but I very much expect Boston to be a hashtag snorty face problem next year as well. And then Denver, man, like I mean, Jokic, we have long said he's just absolutely phenomenal, but if the leap Jamal Murray took in this year's playoffs is not a mirage, if that's actually here to stay, then that answers the question of, you know, they paid him like a superstar. They gave him a 5-year max deal last offseason, and it was one of those, like, where you're paying for what you expect moving forward, not what he had produced to that point. Because he had, you know, he had one really good playoffs before he signed that extension, but he was not consistently excellent. If he could transfer what he did in the playoffs to the regular season next year, he's a superstar. He deserves to be treated like one, and he very much will live up to that contract.
Yep, I agree. And so I think the most important thing for Denver is just to not make another trade where you lose as much talent as you did at the trade deadline.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that was still a talent downgrade. I understand the contractual obligations that came with it that they forego, you know, because of it. Fine. But, you know, I look at their roster now and I still think that there is still, you know, a small need of some upgrades and, you know, in terms of the depth. Granted, Will Barton did not play at all in the bubble. That's a huge loss. The team would have looked different. Hell, they might even have made the finals if he'd been there.
Mm-hmm.
So, reasonable. That said, when you look at the roster, outside of Jamal Murray, who wasn't even a knockdown shooter until they arrived in the bubble, no Nugget player hit over 2 triples a game. And I think in today's league in particular, when you have someone like Jokic, who's such a great passer, you need to flank him with knockdown shooters. And I wonder if Denver is just falling short of that.
Do you think Denver regrets making those moves? Like, had Denver known it was going to be in the conference finals this year, do they just take the loss on Malik? Like, we know we're not going to be able to pay Malik Beasley what he's going to get in free agency. Or maybe, I mean, who knows, man? Like, in theory, he's going to be one of the ones who should, you know, one of the rare guys who should get more than the MLE, despite the brutal cap environment this offseason. But, like, I wonder if, had the Denver Nuggets known what was to come, you know, coronavirus pandemic, blasting the NBA finances, and then them making it to the conference finals, if they just would have said, like, screw it, we're going to, you know, if Malik Beasley leaves in free agency, that's fine, but, like, we're just going to give it our best shot this year.
Yeah. Oh, I think if you asked them this question right now and they said, no, we wouldn't be interested in that, then they would be wrong. Then they would be making a mistake. Yes, absolutely. Look, now we also have somewhat confirmation that Gary Harris is not going to, you know, be that guy again, at least not offensively.
Mm-hmm.
So I still think they need a shooting guard, and not a, you know, positional shooting guard, but a guard who can shoot.
Right.
That's Malik Beasley. And he is really athletic as well. I mean, defensively, yes, there are some shortcomings there. But those could get fixed. It's not like he's old. Like, he's younger than Harris is. So, yeah, absolutely. And I will go further and say, if they do not make a valid effort this year in keeping PJ Dozier, that's another one they could end up seeing develop elsewhere, who they just let slip through their fingers. I'm a little bit worried about, you know, why they, you know, I understand the contractual obligations that, you know, that they were there if they kept them around, but you still need talent. Mm-hmm. It's the Western Conference of the NBA. And when you are trading away talent to save a buck, that's when you get down.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we talked about it a couple episodes ago. I think a lot of teams might find themselves in that position this offseason, depending on where the cap comes in. Just because, you know, they've been planning with a certain number in mind, and it's not going to be that number. It's going to be most likely at least, you know, 6 to 7 million lower. We'll see if, you know, maybe they freeze or they keep the tax at where it was projected to be, just to not totally screw over teams in that regard. And maybe there'll just be more room between the cap and the tax as usual. Like, we're shooting in the dark here, because we just, it's, you know, there's no way to know for sure what's going to happen and how teams can't even realistically start to plan for specifics for their offseason, because no one knows how much cap space they're going to have. You have a rough idea, or the rough idea is that most teams don't have cap space this offseason, but, you know, a team like Atlanta, which is one of the few that will, doesn't know exactly how much it will have. But yeah, I mean, I do wonder, you know, given, like, Malik Beasley, when they traded him in February, they correctly assumed he was going to get probably like $15 million a year at least. And I wonder if that offer is still going to be there. It should be.
Oh, no. But I mean, in this market, in this economy, I mean, it might. I hope for Malik's sake it is.
Right.
But I don't think so. And remember, the sample size of him in Minnesota was like 14 games.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I'm not saying that he wasn't dramatically better in Minnesota, because obviously he was, and it's a big part of why I'm a believer in him. But it, you know, you still have to remember it was a 14 game sample size. You know, 21 points and 5 rebounds per game might not be what you're getting on a nightly basis next year.
Right.
You might get 15 or 16, and then you have to wonder, okay, you know, we don't know when the coronavirus is going to get, you know, that pandemic is going to be over because we have a vaccine or whatever. So I wouldn't be shocked to see them offer him something like what the Denver Nuggets offered him that he declined, which was, I think, 3 years, 30, right?
I think it was something along those lines. I don't remember the specifics, but yeah, that wouldn't shock me.
But either. I mean, and I think I have to assume as well that, you know, Beasley's agent would look at that offer in a different light, given everything that's transpired since. Mm-hmm. Like, one thing is you get that offer last year, a year from now, then 2020 happened.
Right.
I mean, you would have to at least look at that offer. You might decline it either way, but you have to look at that offer and go, yeah, this is actually weirdly worth more now than last year, just because of all the surrounding elements that are moving about. So I wouldn't be shocked to see them give him that offer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a tough spot for a lot of free agents to be in, as we've covered and we will continue to cover, at least until we have a better sense of where the cap is going to be. But
yeah,
I mean, it puts certain, like, the teams like the Lakers, like the Bucks and Celtics are very likely going to be in the tax again, depending on where the exact line falls. But, you know, teams that are contenders that will have the full non-taxpayer mid-level are going to have such an advantage, just because so many teams won't have cap space this summer, that, like, I think you're going to get better players for that non-taxpayer mid-level than you typically would in a given year. And now, you know, maybe some free agents just read the market correctly and just say, I'd rather just take a one-year balloon deal with my incumbent team and, you know, re-sign with Bird, right? So maybe that isn't true, but it wouldn't totally shock me if, you know, you're able to lock in a lot of guys at below market values this year.
Yeah, definitely agree on that.
Yeah. So, Mort, any other big takeaways from the playoffs that you think, you know, looking ahead to draft free agency trades that you think we should address?
Well, I mean, under normal circumstances, in a normal draft, you know, we might be able to take a few things away and go, oh, we should really focus on this, this, and that. But this draft is just so weird. I think it might be the most appropriate draft of any year just because of the weirdness that was the 2019-2020 season. But I don't think there's anything to learn from this. You know how those after-school specials always had like a point after the episode? Like, so kids, what did we learn today?
Right.
When someone is sitting around asking that question about this particular NBA season, my answer is not a goddamn thing. This was all weird.
Yeah. No, I think that's the right read, unfortunately. It's like, I guess it begs the question of like, should teams, and I don't want to say overreact, because I mean, I think a lot of teams already have, like a lot of teams fired their coaches based on what happened in the bubble. But, you know, should teams be careful about reading too much into what happened, knowing that next year, again, we don't know what the contours of next season are going to look like, where they're going to play, if they're going to, it sounds like they want to play in their home stadiums during the regular season.
Right.
We don't know how that plan is going to work, if it's going to be successful, if they're going to bubble in the postseason again. You know, like the factors that were so unique to the bubble, like having no travel, not having as many back-to-backs during those seeding games. I think one, you know, there was one back-to-back per team for the seeding games. Having 4 months of rest beforehand where, you know, teams had to get their legs back under them, basically. Like, the conditioning element is hard to, you know, conceptualize. And then also a team like the Clippers where guys were going in and out of the bubble for whatever reason. Like, I just wonder whether teams are going to look at this and be like, well, we could really take away nothing from this. It was just like a complete
right
one-time fluke, and like, we'll get back to normal next year. And like, you know, I wonder if they think the playoffs would have played out differently had the season, you know, had coronavirus never happened.
Oh, I think it would have. Yeah, I think everyone would agree. I mean, when you have a, what was it, four-month layoff?
Mm-hmm.
Three and a half, four? Or was it four and a half? I don't even remember.
Yeah, four and a half.
Four and a half months. Jesus. Okay. When you have that, it's undoubtedly going to affect something. I mean, look, the Bucks, even before the playoffs, you know, in the bubble, looked completely out of sync compared to what they did in the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
The Clippers as well. Those were the championship favorites, or the finals favorites. And they just played weirdly. And you look at the Denver Nuggets. Had Jamal Murray taken that leap, if not for the 4.5 months off? We don't know. Presumably not. I mean, maybe he just sat back and watched a ton of tape and just decided, oh, I got it. I figured it out. I watched a ton of tape. Now I understand.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to go ape every single game. Whoa, there's the solution.
Right.
I don't know what, but something, right? Something had to click and something had to happen. And I think that 4.5 month gap, which was essentially an off season, yeah, absolutely changed the playoffs. And I, to the point where the Lakers shouldn't have won it, I don't know. I can't sit here and say that, mm-hmm. but I mean, could be? I mean, feasibly? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Either way, no, I don't think you can take anything away from that outside of trends, as we talked about when we started this episode. Like, you know, wings are really important. Why, you know, you don't necessarily want to go after a big man who is reliant upon guards to set him up, yada, yada. Yeah, like,
mm-hmm.
Those on-court patterns, yes, you can take something away from those, but in terms of, like, you know, what we learned about this season, no, You know, we lost David Stern, we lost Kobe Bryant, Jerry Sloan, Wes Unseld as well. So outside of that, you know, and having a global pandemic on the hands, you know, the whole China scandal earlier in the season as well. I mean, everything was just ridiculous, and the league had so many storylines, it was impossible to ignore it. I mean, I have never gotten this many phone calls, Brian, from Danish media, you know, around the country, just basically, you know, asking me, so Morten, can you come on the radio, or can you go in this newspaper to just explain to us what's going on? Because everything was just so weird.
Right.
Like, is this common that an NBA general manager, you know, talks negatively about China? No, it's not. Oh, but is it a bad thing? It's not a bad thing. It was actually a good thing. But the league lost money. Yeah. So we already started there, right, having a very, very huge debate. And then it just escalated into all the other things that I talked about. So, yeah, no. This was just a one-off, hopefully. And if 2021 decides to be even weirder than this, then I'm canceling my membership on Life.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah, I mean, I'm with you in, like, I don't know that anything would have materially changed about the final outcome. Like, the Lakers were, right, despite what some people are trying to retcon you into believing, the Lakers were among the title favorites all year. Everyone acknowledged that. The title odds in pretty much every conversation involved Lakers, Clippers, Bucks, one of those three teams. You know, do I think certain series might have played out differently had there been travel and had there been fans in the stadiums, and, you know, had Game 7s been at the home team stadium? Possibly. You know, does Denver come back from 2-3-1 deficits without home court advantage, particularly in the second round? I don't know, but that's, you know, it's a testament to the teams that made the best of this weird situation and overcame all of it. Like, I going back to pre-bubble, there was always the, like, does this championship deserve an asterisk talk? And I think, having watched all of it play out, no. It's always going to have that, like, the pandemic championship caveat, but I don't think that's an asterisk necessarily. Like, I don't think this championship, I don't think it should be like, the Lakers have 16 championships plus one. Like, no, they just have 17 championships. Like, they...
Of course
they do. You know, like, weird stuff happens every year in the playoffs. Like, are we cheapening the Raptors title last year because KD and Klay got hurt? No, like, they took advantage of the situation that was in front of them. You know, do we cheapen the 2018 Warriors title because Chris Paul strained his hamstring? No, like, they still had to win those games. This year in particular is weirder than most. No doubt about that. I hope to God that we never have a year like this again. But, you know, that the Lakers did what they did in spite of all of it. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, I really, really, really do not envy general managers, but specifically cap guys right now. Because, they just must be waiting on pins and needles, knowing, you know, these negotiations are ongoing. It sounds like Woj reported there's optimism that they might have these updated figures within the next few weeks. But until you have that, it's just like, I don't know how you begin forming concrete plans for the offseason.
Well, I mean, I do think NBA teams, you know, having had the 4.5 months off, knowing that this could be a reality later on, I think there's been made so many contingencies. And I wouldn't be shocked if they, like most teams, have like 5 plans rolled out where they basically grouped together like certain salary cap numbers and said, okay, so if the cap lands between, you know, 99 and 102, then we can go this route. Mm-hmm. And if it lands between 102 and 105, we can go this, whatever. You know, I think, you know, the well-prepared teams, they'll be fine. You know, the teams that are able to look ahead a little bit and, you know, understand the reality of the situation, they will be fine. And thankfully, to me at least, it seems like NBA teams are good at doing that. You know, it does seem like we have a league where they are very, very good at hiring the right people to look ahead long term, which is obviously a problem if you're the Houston Rockets and your owner is Tillman Fertitta. But outside of them, you know, I feel the league is in good hands.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting offseason. But listeners, we will try to walk you through it as best as we can and make sense of all the nonsense as best we can. But I think for now, that is a good place to wrap up. So thank you, as always, for listening in today. Hope you're staying safe out there. And for all the Americans out there, hope, you know, the election is exactly 2 weeks from today. So please, please, please make a plan to vote if you haven't already. If you have, thank you. Now go bully your friends into doing it too. We have this responsibility once every 4 years. Let's take advantage of it. On that note, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and we are being hosted on Spreaker. So check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Mort, now that the NBA is over, any movie or TV reviews for us?
Yes. So I was watching The Trial of the Chicago 7 on Netflix, the newly released blockbuster from Aaron Sorkin, and it was great. It was just, it's a historical drama, obviously, of the Chicago riots back in 1968 at the Democratic National Convention. So when I saw the cast and I saw Sacha Baron Cohen in it, I was like, oh boy. Oh, is he going to take this seriously? Because this is not like a spoof film.
Sure.
And he is wonderful.
Oh.
Just wonderful. Eddie Redmayne also steals the show. It's a great, great cast. The script writing, obviously, it's Aaron Sorkin who wrote The West Wing and The Newsroom and all the, like, he's an incredible writer. And he's also directing this. I believe it's his second movie that he directed after, that movie with Jessica Chastain, you know, called Molly something, about Molly's Game, I think it was called. Mm. It's much in the same vein in how it's directed, and it's just, it's good. It's like 2 hours or something like that, 2 hours and 15 minutes. Just sit down and enjoy it. I mean, yes, it's politically driven, but in today's climate, I really didn't expect anything else.
Sure.
So, yeah. And and Joseph Gordon-Levitt is in it as well. And as always, he's fantastic, and I'm very envious that he's, you know, nearing 40 and he's looks like someone who's 25 because, yeah, he just does.
Yeah.
So The Trial of the Chicago 7. And then one other film. This is going to be a twofer. Also from this year, An American Pickle, which is a dark comedy by Seth Rogen.
Oh.
So, yeah. Basically, okay, so the premise is pretty ridiculous. An immigrant worker at a pickle factory is accidentally preserved for 100 years, and he wakes up in New York, like modern-day New York,
okay,
and has to adapt to life in 2020.
Mm.
The premise is typically, you know, Seth Rogen ridiculous,
mm-hmm,
but his performance as himself in 2020, or not, he doesn't play Seth Rogen, he plays a character in 2020, and then he plays the immigrant worker back from 1920. It's got a lot of heart in it. Hmm. It's not your typical Seth Rogen gets stoned comedy. I gave it a 6 out of 10 because the premise is a little bit out there. But he really acted his ass off. I don't think I've seen a better Seth Rogen performance ever.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, all of that is good to know. I have nothing. I've still been bitching Last Man on Earth, which is getting progressively darker. It is. I'm near the end of season one. And, it's taken. The main character is just becoming more and more deplorable. But and I have a feeling there might hopefully be a turn for him soon, because he is truly a detestable human being right now. But
oh yeah,
yeah. In case you haven't had your fill of those,
I was about to say, 2020 has otherwise been so kind to the human people.
Right. But if you want more of that, go watch Last Man on Earth. All right, Mort. Stay safe out there.
Thank you, man. You too. Don't die, man.
Thank you.